inherit.
For Sudan to improve security in Darfur runs out today. The UN is threatening to take action if Sudan fails to disarm militia groups blamed for killing thousands of civilians and forcing huge numbers to flee. The French government is sending one of its officials to Baghdad to negotiate the release of two French journalists taken hostage in Iraq. The group holding the men is demanding that France reverses a law banning the wearing of Islamic headscarves at its schools. British Airways will give free flights to staff as a reward for their hard work. The company has been badly hit by a number of difficulties over the summer, which have caused major problems for passengers. Valerie Jones reports.
In the past week, British Airways have had to cancel more than 100 flights because of staff shortages and technical problems. Thousands of passengers were left stranded, waiting for seats on later flights. British Airways have announced they're giving two free return air tickets to their staff in recognition of the stress they've been under. Passengers who've been affected can apply for compensation. The gesture to the staff comes only days after threatened strike action was called off after a last-minute pay deal. British Airways are now investigating what caused the crisis of staff shortages.
The Afghan capital Kabul is on high alert because of a bomb attack outside the offices of an American security firm which killed seven people. Staff at embassies and aid organizations have been warned to avoid all but essential travel within the city. Three men from Powys in mid-Wales have been killed in a road accident in the Netherlands. It's thought they'd been on their way to the Belgian Grand Prix when their car was struck from behind on a main road near Rotterdam. The Royal Society is urging countries to support a campaign to prevent an international ban being imposed on all forms of human cloning. It says stem cell technology should be used for medical research into diseases. BBC Radio 4 News.
It's almost 3 miles long. It's a vital link for commuting car drivers between Liverpool and the Wirral Peninsula. And it's 70 years old this year. But whatever you do, don't change lanes. On Radio 4 now, the poet and tunnel fan Stuart Henderson goes underground in We Built the Mersey Tunnel, Boys.
I wish I was back in Liverpool, Liverpool town where I was born.
It is a deep pleasure to us to open a thoroughfare so great and strange as this Mersey Tunnel.
Where there ain't no trees, no scented breeze, no fields of waving corn. But there's lots of girls with peroxide curls, and the blackened tan flows free.
I remember it being built, 1934, and King George going down. And there was children outside the tunnel, and they were dressed in red, white and blue.
With six in a bed by the old pier head, and it's Liverpool town for me.
Mersey Tunnel's control room. I will do. You have a breakdown section? Section 6, OK.
We built the Mersey Tunnel, boys, way back in 33. Dug an hole in the ground until we found an hole called Wallasey. And I'm telling you, Jack, we all swam back to dear old Liverpool town. I wish I was...
It's the late 1950s. A small boy in short trousers is nervously munching on a stuffed pork roll sandwich. He's on a Crosville bus, travelling from Liverpool to the Wirral Peninsula through the Mersey Tunnel. He's been told that his adenoidal accent is a direct result of inhaling tunnel fumes. He's also been told by various elderly aunts and uncles that the Mersey Tunnel is the longest, deepest, widest and bestest in the world, with more polished tiles than in all of King Solomon's bathrooms. And if you're very quiet, they told him, you can sometimes hear mermaids singing in the river above. I'm sure I wasn't alone in being told exaggerated stories about the Mersey Tunnel on my first trip down the big rabbit hole at the bottom of William Brown Street. But the strange thing is that I believed all those stories, and I still want to even now. Scousers, you see, always remember their first time.
I would have been 9 then.
George Melly does.
I forget if my father drove me through. He didn't always have a car. I should think it was probably my grandfather's car. He owned Now, what was it called? I remember the sound of the horn. Armstrong Sidley, he had. And so I was driven through and I was very thrilled. And you go in at one end, you pay at those little Art Deco entrances, and there you go through and you go out the other end.
Seventy years ago, the Mersey Tunnel, nearly 2.5 miles long, opened by the then King and Queen, really was a marvel of engineering. Built by nearly 2,000 men, with brawn and muscle, picks and shovels.
The bridge, which was first proposed, was decided against because they were all nervous about the war and they were worried that a bridge would be undefendable.
Steve Binns is the community historian for Liverpool City Council and has a pretty good feel of the horses that were traded to get this particular tunnel started. The key man was council leader Sir Archibald Salvidge.
As one of his opponents said, nobody goes to the toilet in this town without Archie Salvidge knowing it. He saved the government in 1921 over Irish affairs. They owed him one, and the deal he struck was with Churchill. He got an agreement for two things, money and the ability to charge for travel through the tunnel.
Do you think it was one of those deals that was done over brandy and cigars in the Gentlemen's Club?
Yeah, it could have been. Salvidge had a very favourite room in the Adelphi, which he often used for important meetings. And when somebody asked Salvidge how he managed to get money out of a government in difficult times, he said grimly, "They owe me one."
It is a matter of great gratification, the largest dirt-accurate tunnel in the world, a great engineering work of national character and importance to meet the ever-growing transport requirements of the Port of Liverpool.
That royal opening ceremony in the high summer of 1934 still remains one of the true red-letter days of Liverpool's past. Remarkably, it was all recorded for posterity.
Tunnels such as this, wherein many streams of wheel traffic may run below the depth and turbulence of a tidal water bearing the ships of the world.
They were talking about when the Mersey Tunnel opened, the King and Queen were going to open the Mersey Tunnel.
Mary Organ was a schoolgirl at the time of the celebrations.
And the men were up till all hours the night before, painting those cobbles in three streets, white, and the curbstones, which were about that wide, alternate, they were painted red and blue.
And then on the actual day that the tunnel opened, what do you remember about that?
Well, the day the tunnel opened, children were dressed as flowers, hundreds of children on the museum steps. There were pansies, daffodils, tulips, every colour of the rainbow. It was like a carnival atmosphere, you know. And as I say, the sun seemed to shine on the King and Queen, and they just seemed to be a mass of jewels and medals. I've never seen such posh cars in all my life, you know, because, yeah, because nobody had cars then.
I suppose my fascination springs from the knowledge that men of my grandfather's generation sweated and grunted as they cut through the seams of sandstone. But it wasn't all underground work. The architect of the tunnel, Herbert Rouse, also built a grand entrance and giant ventilation shafts. One of them, in St George's Dock, now houses the tunnel's admin, control centre and a sort of gallery tribute to those early human boring machines. One photograph on the wall sort of haunted me. It's of a man, a steel erector in grimy and stained shirt, pulling at a waist-high spanner, his back curved like a straining crescent moon, his gore-blimey caps on back to front, to prevent the constant dripping of seawater from above that could turn his exposed neck into a settlement of salt boils.
We're now going to go down through the ventilation station. So you'll see as we go down, there's lots of these airlock doors.
Peter Arch, present-day engineering manager in charge of the asset, took me on a subterranean tour explaining what it was like to tunnel in the 30s.
I think that damp would have been a major issue, and it would have been dirty. And because you're working in quite a big area, the other danger was actually falling off something that you were working on.
And that happened, didn't it?
And that did happen, unfortunately, yes.
The foreman cried,
"Come on outside, the roof is falling down."
And I'm telling you, Jack, we all swam back to dear old Liverpool town.
Professor David Dunster is the Roscoe Professor of Architecture at the University of Liverpool.
The sandstone on which Liverpool is built is both soft and hard. I think there were special drilling machines that were invented or constructed in order to make this big tube. I would imagine that they would have probably gone wrong from time to time. I don't, for example, know how many people were killed in the construction of it.
It's reported 19.
That's a lot. That's a lot, but not surprising.
What would the conditions have been like for the ordinary men working underground?
Ghastly. Absolutely awful. Dreadful.
Because apparently some suffered salt boils.
Did they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. No, I would imagine that the conditions were disgusting.
That alarm you get is when a fan is at fault.
Well, this is really boy's own excitement, this one, because I'm standing in front of this HAL-like computer, and basically what it is, it's the controls the electrical distribution to all the service areas of the tunnel, and there's sort of little green dials and there's little glowing red things. It is actually quite magical.
Yes, it'll be sad when it goes, when we go on to the new technology. We find it's a lot easier to work with because it's on hand.
And it was just as well it was all on hand. A pensioner, sheltering from the wind in the lee of one of the maintenance blocks, had set off an alarm. Alan and Brian's dashboard lit up like a Christmas tree. High status, red alert. Birkenhead, we have a problem. The pensioner shuffled off, though. Alan relaxed and told me a funny story.
When I actually worked on the tools a number of years ago, I actually went down the inverts one night. And when you go down the inverts, the lighting is obviously, it's only very, very dim. Yeah. And I was walking down there, and you've got natural springs down there. And right in the distance, all I saw was a hand, what appeared to be a hand. And what somebody had done, I put a white latex glove over this fountain of water. And as I'm approaching, all I can see is this hand waving. And it was quite, you know,
spooky.
Oh my God. You know, it took a few minutes to sort of work out what it was exactly, you know.
That was an amazing sort of space age sound.
What was it?
A motor starting up.
Into the tunnel itself.
Yeah, so if we don't, just go to the bottom of the steps and no further.
Certainly, yeah.
And what we can see here is the traffic lane, and if you look up, you see the holes in the ceiling, which is where the extract air is sucked out. And then there's going to be one of these escapes in the central section every 200 yards. I always talk in yards because this tunnel was built in feet and inches.
Overall, the Mersey Tunnel cost over £7 million. But there's no doubt that it was far ahead of its time in easing traffic congestion. Former Conservative Transport Minister and son of Liverpool, Steve Norris.
To get to a major thoroughfare that was actually new build and tolled was still regarded as quite unusual. My memory is that actually it wasn't particularly successful in terms of the tolling element. The admin cost of the tunnel and the supervision ate up far too much of the revenue. That's a reflection, I suspect, of the fact that the tunnel never really made its original projections of numbers for quite a few years. But as a financing model, the modern equivalent, if you like, of the PFI or the PPP project, yeah, it was quite advanced for its time.
Just by St Luke's Church, I forget the name of it now. There was a place there that sold second-hand scooters, and we went down and I paid £75 for a second-hand Puch. Steve rode it back to my house in Woolton with me on the back.
Newsreader and former head boy of Liverpool Institute, Peter Sissons, took his life in his hands in his teens on a scooter that schoolmate, the same Steve Norris, had persuaded him to buy.
I got a job acting as a security guard for Security Corps, a glorified night watchman. And it took me to Bromborough, just the other side of the river, and had to go through the Mersey Tunnel on my scooter, which was the most terrifying experience, because these big lorries, even then, would overtake you if you weren't keeping your speed up, which meant that you could touch them as they went past, and that was terrifying.
And with there being no central reservation, if you fell off...
Oh.
Good night, Vienna.
Death trap. Absolute death trap.
The construction of the tunnel was an enormous project, with a labour force drawn mainly from Merseyside's large Irish community. Winnie Cook's father was a face worker whose first language was Gaelic.
It was him and his two brothers worked on the tunnel, and an uncle. My uncle came from the Aran Islands. Times were bad then, you know, and they could come into Birkenhead, go to a certain pub, get set up with a job, set up with lodgings, no problem. Because it was work, you know, that other people wouldn't do, because there was many slights cast at my older brothers and sisters. They used to say, like, he worked under the hammer. Like, you know, like all the Irish. But the thing was, it was work. And I can relate, really, to them coming here then and what's happening now. It might be bad here, people say, but it's a lot worse where I come from.
I'm fascinated by this opening ceremony, this day, this fantastic day when the King and Queen came, because it was a brilliant summer's day in the middle of July, and they probably passed down this road that we're driving along now. And Liverpool had put on its finest. It was suited, it was booted. And one of the bands that were actually playing on that day was the old Liverpool City Police Band, now the Merseyside Police Band, and we're going along to see them now. And they're going to be playing one of the pieces that perhaps was played on that day, that great day. Hiya, how are you doing? Is that the Merseyside Police Band, is it?
It is, yeah.
Oops, through another door. Thanks. Better answer that phone. Could be a 999 call. With Mal Peters, director of music for the Merseyside Police Band. Mal, you just played a sort of a spirited melody of the sort of hits of the day. Would that those have been the numbers they would have been playing on
the
day?
Yeah, there were a couple of numbers there from the late 1920s. Isla Capri, that was in that medley, was actually written in 1934. Sally was written in about 1931, and Roll Out the Barrel, similarly written in 1933. So they'd have been at the cutting edge.
I mean, if you just look at some of the archive photographs and see those people and the events leading up, for the whole week leading up to the actual official opening day, there were so many events taking place, and the band seemed to be involved in just about everything. So a major event, without a doubt.
And then I met 93-year-old Arthur Kincaid. He was part of the Guard of Honour in the King's Regiment on the opening day.
There were thousands and thousands of people. It was a glorious hot day.
It must have been terribly hot.
It was rather warm. And there were one or two remarks how miserable looking the Queen was. She never sort of smiled, did she?
Perhaps she didn't like tunnels.
Perhaps she didn't like Liverpool.
Robert McCoy didn't make it down to the tunnel on opening day, but still received what he always thought, and probably still does, a right royal gift.
I visited my grandmother, and she told me that she had been herself to the tunnel and had had a chat with the king. And during that chat, she told the king that it was my birthday, and the king gave her half a crown to give me. And of course, half a crown in those days was huge riches. 15 Mars bars, or 30 ice cream cornets. I was looked upon as a great celebrity with the kids in the school. Having half a crown at all gave you great celebrity, but getting it from the king, even more so, of course.
But sometimes, just sometimes, the face in the crowd turns out to be something more.
Everybody walked through the tunnel, and it was a long walk, but it was nice, windy.
For Laura Waugh, Cupid was hanging around that day.
And other people were coming through from Liverpool. Incidentally, I passed my future husband, but didn't know at the time.
Did you?
Yes. Funny that, isn't it? And he came from Crosby, you see, with his mother. And the strange thing is, you know, when they opened the other tunnel at Kingsway, we both walked through, my husband and I, and my daughter was doing a sponsored walk for the high school in Wallasey. So she was passing us. Funny that, wasn't it?
So the tunnel for you was a tunnel of love?
Oh, yes.
Hello, and Enterprise on Merseyside. This week it better change its name, I think, to Enterprise Under Mersey, because that's where we're going today, down the new Mersey Tunnel.
Back to the archive. And for those of us too young to have been there in 1934, there was some small consolation when the second Mersey Tunnel, the Kingsway Tunnel, was constructed in the late 60s. There were regular updates on its progress on Radio Merseyside, and the late Bob Azurdia was forever going underground.
And with that mighty explosion, which in fact even knocked out one of the television cameras, the final side of the wall is down.
First of all, I was standing alongside Alderman Sefton.
Joining Bob for that breakthrough moment was what sounds like a slightly swaying local councillor.
After that first tunnel, which was regarded as the eighth wonder of the world, here we are at it again. One, two, three.
It's not the leaving of Liverpool that grieves me, but my darling, when I think...
Going through that giant mouth, perfect amazement.
Journalist Gillian Reynolds describes herself as pure Liverpool.
Coming out in Birkenhead was always a place of magic and adventure. You wouldn't think it was like 5 minutes away. You'd think it was another world.
Do you think it's stood the test of time as a construction?
Oh, yes. Oh, I think so. I remember going to Boston when I went to graduate school in America and someone saying to me, you must come and see our tunnel, the tunnel out to Logan. And I went through that tunnel and I said, call that a tunnel? Ours is older, ours is bigger, ours is grander. And the original Mersey Tunnel still stands for grandeur. I mean, you know, you look at the Blackwall Tunnel in London, not in the halfpenny specs with ours. Ours is just brilliant.
But there are always a few incidents to report. In 1959, Stirling Moss was prosecuted for changing lanes at high speed. He was fined a tenner. But the experience served him well. He went on to win the next two Monaco Grand Prix, stealing through the pack in the Monte Carlo tunnel. Of course, if Sir Stirling had had Liverpool's most famous advocate acting for his defence, he'd have kept the titles and the tenor.
I think it was a psychological breakthrough. I also think it was a social breakthrough.
Rex Makin is a legal legend in Liverpool and another tunnel philosopher.
My grandparents, who lived at the bottom of Park Lane, their idea of recreation was to walk to the pierhead. Mm. And I think all that ended, really, after the tunnel was opened, because people didn't have to sit there. They could scoot through to Hoylake, West Kirby. People who live on islands like the Isle of Man or Bermuda or somewhere like that will always tell you when you live on an island, you have a great desire to get off it.
Mm.
And I think there was a similar psychological uplift for people in Liverpool.
Willie Russell was so inspired by the escape offered by the Mersey Tunnel that it featured in his play, Our Day Out, about Liverpool pupils experiencing the world beyond their desperate, dull-beckoning streets.
Well, our day out is about a teacher called Mrs. K, who wants to take her progress class kids, progress class being a euphemism for the maladjusted, the educationally subnormal, and the, you know, those who don't want to do anything. She wants to take them all out on a trip to Conway for the day. And what she wants to do is just give them the experience of being out of school. And that comes from that very Liverpool mythologised thing of through the tunnel into Wales. And I remembered this song that I used to do kind of a version of in the folk clubs in my kind of early youth. And so I gave it to some of the kids because it's a deliberately anarchic kind of kids' song because it's slightly rude and so it's taking the piss out of the teachers, you know.
And it goes like
this. The tunnel is 3 miles long and the roof is made of glass, so that you can drive right in and watch the ships go past. There's a plug hole every 5 yards, they unplug every night. It lets in all the water and it washes away the da 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 da.
The people that look after the tunnel now claim that it's a constant case of tender loving care to keep it open, but there's still a running sore. Under the original deal brokered by Archibald Salvage, Winston Churchill in the Treasury allowed tolls for the first 20 years of operation. This period was subsequently extended. And extended.
The County Council is already proposing, though, to put the tolls for private cars up to 20 pence. So really,
yes.
Is that...
And so, tolls on the first tunnel continue 70 years and 700 million vehicles later.
It's a gargantuan load of tripe. That's all I can say about that. In plain dockside language, chuck it.
The image of that anonymous man in a cap wielding a huge spanner lingered. I didn't know it, but I was soon to find out who he was when Frank McMullen started showing me some of his old family photographs over afternoon tea at the Adelphi.
Years ago, my kids bought me this book.
Wow.
So when I seen that, I knew that was me father, me dad.
Yeah.
Frank's father was Tom McMullen, known by all as Mac. The famous photograph of him was published in the papers at the time, a symbol of the mighty work going on below the river. But just a few weeks after it was taken, Mac became another Mersey Tunnel casualty.
All I know was, or so I've been told, that they were moving the scaffolding, and as the scaffolding moved, there was a ladder attached to it on the top, and the ladder fell. Father was bending over, and it hit him across the neck and the spine, and I believe the four top vertebrae were gone.
It is remarkable looking at this photograph because it is so atmospheric and it conjures up so much, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
You know, there's a determination in his body posture. You know, here is a man hard at work.
Well, having said that, and I can only say what I know, you know, I'm looking back over the hindsight's a beautiful thing, isn't it? I suppose Dad, anyway, was pretty well paid compared to other businesses and trades and that. But I don't think we wanted that much.
But you weren't on the parish.
No, that's true, yeah. And there was a lot of people were at the time.
Was there a sense of bitterness, you know?
I don't think he held much about it. It was a job, it happened, you know. It was a happening, and you won't believe it, but I used the tunnel quite often.
Do you?
Say a little one for the old man when I'm down there. Yeah.
It's not easy to enthuse about a tunnel. It is, after all, a borough with traffic lights. But from 1934, the Mersey Tunnel has seen a whole scrapbook of Armstrong Siddeleys and bread vans bound for Bebbington. Giant fans have extracted a near continent of fumes, and the ghosts of men like Tom McMullen, with their caps on backwards, take their bow. They're the ones who can really say, we built the Mersey Tunnel, boys. way back in 33.
The foreman cried, come on outside, the roof is falling down.
And I'm telling you, Jack, we all swam back to dear old Liverpool town.
All right, Percy, roll the credits.
We Built the Mersey Tunnel Boys was presented by Stuart Henderson and produced by David Prest. And it was a Whistledown production for BBC Radio 4. And with a word about you and yours later on this morning, here's Liz Barclay.
There may be no such thing as a free lunch, but one fast food chain is giving away freebies with lunch. Magazines and cereal firms have been doing the same for years. So aren't we all immune to the marketing ploy? Or do we still like the idea that we're getting something for nothing? 100 years ago, a holiday scheme was set up in Leeds to take disadvantaged children away for holidays during the summer. This summer, a group of adults who visited the camp as children returned to see the changes and relive their experiences. How does it all look all these years later? And is there still a need for these kinds of holiday facilities today? And the play's the thing. But to be or not to be in the audience, that's the question for disabled visitors to Stratford-on-Avon. We check out the access. That's you and yours at 12:04.
With Liz Barclay and Stuart Flinders. Now it's time for our new serial.
John Moffat as Hercule Poirot and Philip Jackson as Chief Inspector Japp in Agatha Christie's 1-2 Buckle My Shoe.
It has always been a matter of considerable wonder to me that while I can stand and face a man pointing a loaded pistol at my head with a certain amount of composure, the sight of a dentist's chair never fails to reduce me to a state of craven trembling.